What do you make of that sound? It's been travelling across the universe for 130 million years, and when it flashed past Earth on August the 17th, it sparked 3,500 astronomers into action. I'm Roland Pease, and the people I've been talking to for this edition of Science in Action from the BBC say they've not had a day's rest since. Much of this programme is given over to why the first light and sound show in astronomy is so revealing about the cosmos. But we do also have time to mull over the intelligence of whales and dolphins.
They're constantly playing. In fact, they play with other species. So bottlenose dolphins are known to play with humpback whales, just as me might play with a dog, right? But they spend an awful lot of time doing that. And here I am stuck in a radio station doing work.
No, this is fun, and no more so than with the big astronomical story of the week. No, of the year. Not the first time I've heard astronomers celebrate our human capacity to understand a near-infinite universe. A testament to the intellect that was forged on the dangerous plains of East Africa hundreds of thousands of years ago. Many have asked how our brain became so powerful. Comparisons have been made to chimps and other primates, but the lessons from them are confused precisely because they share a common ancestry with us. Now, a study in Nature, Ecology and Evolution has come out comparing us with whales, dolphins and other so-called cetaceans. Despite the chatter, they're so different, I struggled to see the relevance. But author Michael Muthukrishna told me that's precisely the point.
Cetaceans are perfect for that because they're so evolutionarily distant to us. They may as well be evolutionary aliens, and they live in this strange underwater world that may as well be a different planet. So what are some of the similarities? The larger brain cetaceans, much like the large brain primates, they will look after their kin. So aunts and uncles will look after babies. They help each other out in ways that maybe even we wouldn't help each other out. So a dolphin male might help another female mate with another male. It's hard to mate in the water. They use signature whistles, so they seem to have names for each other. And we hear them using these signature whistles even when the person isn't present. So it's almost like they're gossiping or they're saying, you know, so-and-so knows where the best food is. We should find where they are.
And this applies not just to, let's say, blue whales, which is what we always think of when we talk about whales, or just dolphins. You see these things across all the species.
The amazing thing about this and what allowed us to conduct our study is that we see a lot of variance. So we see very small-brained whales, typically, and porpoises that don't display a lot of these behaviors. And then we see very large-brained bottlenose dolphins and killer whales. And there is where we see these complex behaviors, just as we predicted.
And brain size is the key in this.
Well, they're co-evolutionary. So there's these positive feedback loops where brain size co-evolves with these tight-knit social groups, which co-evolve with these large behavioral repertoires for very specific reasons that I can get into if you'd like.
So it's this correlation between brain size and, I don't know if this is the right phrase, social group structure or complexity?
Yeah, so the larger brains can manage and store more information in general, absolutely. Animals can be kind of separated into two groups. Animals that primarily learn by themselves, so they trial and error learning, or they have genetically hardwired instincts, and animals that rely a lot on social learning. So rather than try to figure things out for themselves, they allow each animal to figure things out, and then they learn from each other. So instead of finding all the food sources, you allow this large group to seek them out, find who knows, and then copy that person or animal in this case. And so we would expect then that these large brains are large because they belong to groups where you interact with other members of the group regularly and can gather knowledge from them. So as a result of this, you get this tight-knit social group. It might be large, but it's also a situation where you know who everyone is and you know who's got this information. The behavioral repertoire within that group is very large because there's lots of different behaviors being modeled that you can learn. How to hunt, for example, how to seek out particular food sources. And then this in turn feeds back on allowing you to support that larger brain because you can feed it now with all of this wonderful knowledge.
So in human evolution, I think this is what you're going around. You see two things. One is that we start to stand up and we have hands. We learn how to make the first stone axes and then, you know, we end up with microphones and radio sets and stuff like that.
Yeah.
On one hand, it's the individual technical skill, but at the same time, we have complex societies. And it sounds to me like this is the area you're looking at.
That is exactly right. So the cultural brain hypothesis in particular, basically humans follow the same pattern. We are an outlier. So something happened where we had the same pattern where higher social kind of behaviors are associated with larger brains, but then we kind of went off on this other path. Now, people think the reason that we did it is because we're brilliant individually. But in fact, it's kind of not true. It's kind of this myth of human intelligence. We have societies that are brilliant, but this knowledge has been accumulating to the point where no one really understands the world we live in. I come from the London School of Economics. The economy functions whether you understand it or not, but we're trying to unravel it after the fact. How does that happen? Well, when you begin to learn from other people and you do it without really understanding and you do it selectively, you can get this second line of inheritance. So we call this dual inheritance theory. We have this genetic line, which every animal on earth has from your parents, and this cultural line that we get from our societies. So humans follow the same path, but we went off on this separate pathway. Now, you mentioned hands, right? Hands are tremendously useful because you can communicate with them, you can gesture, and you can also make very sophisticated tools. And if you're bipedal, you can pick those tools up and take them somewhere else, which reduces the cost of actually manufacturing them because you don't have to manufacture them in every place, right? So dolphins are held back by the lack of hands, and they're probably also held back because it's kind of tough to light a fire underwater.
But they still have this developed brain.
They do. So I was kind of setting the limitations on where they're going to go with that. They seem to be paralleling our evolution despite being so distant, which says a lot about the models that we were testing.
I just love the idea that somewhere there's a parallel to you underwater saying, do you know, I think we ought to go and look at those humans and see if they're as clever as us.
Right, right. You know, the amount of time that they spent in leisure makes me wonder if we really are the more intelligent species.
Well, if that's what it takes, I'm ready to chill out and relax until I'm back next week for another edition of Science in Action. Thanks for the advice, Michael Muthukrishna. No such leisure, though, for producer Fiona Roberts, who will be looking for another batch of science, tech and medical stories. You can get more on the Blingnova and dolphin intelligence we've just been talking about from our website at bbcworldservice.com, plus, of course, our past podcasts. I'm Roland Pease. Just time to say one more time...